I think it is the greatest story of immigration ever committed to film. Specifically U.S. immigration, I should say. The greatest story of U.S. immigration ever committed to film. Because it's a story about America, and specifically the promise of America versus the reality of America. Mm-hmm. And by extension, it is also a story about belonging in America. Mm-hmm. And within a family. So it's all about those things all at once. And of course, it's beautifully shot and beautifully acted and all of that other good stuff.
Welcome back to Open Form. I'm Michael Denzel Smith. The Corleone family is one of the most powerful organized crime families in New York City. For youngest son Michael, clear-eyed about who his family is and what they do, there's an internal struggle of loving them regardless and also wanting to distance himself from the family business. But when the patriarch, Vito Corleone, is hospitalized after an assassination attempt, Michael reconsiders his position in the family and turns to bear the responsibility his brothers have proved ill-equipped to handle. This week's film is The Godfather, and it was chosen by Leila Lalami, author of the Pulitzer finalist, The Moore's Account, and National Book Award finalist, The Other Americans.
I've been waiting for this moment, right? Like the whole idea of the podcast is that the author chooses. So I'm not imposing, you know, a film on anyone, but this is truly my favorite. I feel like such a cliche. This is truly my favorite movie of all time. I've watched it so many times. I told my partner that like you had chosen The Godfather, and she was like, "Are you gonna watch it again?" I was like, "Yeah, obviously." And I love what you're saying. This story of U.S. immigration, because like we start the very beginning, right? What's the first line? I believe in America.
Right?
The Undertaker is saying that he believes in America, but he goes on to tell this story about like not getting justice in America. And who is he turning to? Vito Corleone, to say, can you get me justice? And it's like, for whatever else the film is about in turn, or like the core of what is presenting in terms of the mafia and all this stuff, what it is to say that like the systems have failed us, right? Like the systems have not welcomed us in. So we have formed our own means of meting out justice and our, you know, basing our prosperity on our familial connections and the ability to work alongside one another. And that comes with a lot of other things, right? Obviously it comes with lots of violence and all that. But at the core, it's to say that we are the rejects, and we have decided to form our own systems to protect us.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's such a beautiful scene, and especially the way that it opens with that close-up of the Undertaker, and mm-hmm. obviously a minor character in the film, but it's a bold choice that you begin with him very close, mm-hmm. and with I Believe in America, and then he goes and describes this incredible story of assault and injustice, and the fact that whatever the cops did, he did not think was enough. Mm-hmm. The whole thing about that scene is that it functions both as a critique of the American justice system, about the fact that the police has not been much help, but also it really gestures to the theme of belonging in the movie, because at the end of the day, when America fails you, you turn to your family. And in this case, the character, the Godfather, is who he comes to get justice. And that's something that obviously Michael is going to spend the next 3 hours in the movie trying to figure out whose side he's on. And the movie really is basically saying that at the end of the day, no matter what happens and no matter what this country promises you, you're going to have to stick with your family. You're going to have to stick with your kin. At least that's the choice that Michael has to
make.
I can't remember the last time that you invited me to your house for a cup of coffee. Even though my wife is godmother to your only child. But let's be frank, yeah. You never wanted my friendship, and you were afraid to be in my debt.
I didn't want to get into trouble.
I understand. You found paradise in America. Had a good trade, made a good living. Police protected you, and there were courts of law. You didn't need a friend. But now you come to me and you say, Don Corleone, and give me justice.
Because it's so interesting thinking about that and thinking about, like, you know, Vito, three sons, one daughter, two of his sons involved in the family business. But he, you know, as he says later in the film, sort of has hopes for Michael to be able to do something else, to be able to essentially assimilate into the greater American scheme, right? And to say that you would one day be one of the politicians that I'm paying off, right? And Michael is on that track, right? Like, he has gone to college. He joined the World War II effort. He is being very Americanized in, like, all of the Americana, right? Like, all of the things that are part of what we like to think of as the ideal, right? Like, or the dream. But when it comes down to it, his choices are to continue on that, or to choose his family and everything that comes with. Now, he makes a choice of his family, but also trying to get his family out of the business that they're in. And that comes with its own complications that get explored in Godfather Part Two. But like you're saying, like, it comes back to the family again and again. And it's to say that, like, there, it feels like for Michael, like, to consider that there must be something that he's seeing in that dream that just doesn't hold up, even with all of the resources that he has, even as he's, like, making the effort, that there's something. And I think, you know, there's a point in the film where obviously it sort of breaks. It gets punched in the face by a police officer, right? But I think that it's very clear that, like, you know, it's pushing, trying to be a part of the American dream, but even then you just butt up against something that prevents you from being fully accepted.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting too about the character of Michael, and again, to go back to that opening scene, is that he, in a sense, becomes another Bonacera, the undertaker. Because Michael, as you mentioned, is the college educated golden boy. And on top of that, he's a war hero. Like, what better way to express your Americanness than to join the American armed forces?
Right.
And at the beginning of the movie, when his sister is getting married and they have that beautiful ceremony, Michael is narrating everything for his girlfriend. Mm-hmm. So he's an outsider, and he's narrating almost in an anthropological way everything that's happening within the Italian family. But when his father gets shot, who is Michael going to turn to? I mean, the police are not going to do anything to redress the fact that the godfather has been shot. He's a mobster, and the police, in any case, they're corrupt. So Michael really becomes like Bonacer. He has no recourse. He cannot put his faith in American institutions to redress what has been done to his father. The only thing he can do is decide to, like, either leave it alone, or he's going to join the family. He's going to go back and do this. And that's why he decides to take the shot himself. And that sends him to, of course, Italy. And that's another thing that I love about this movie, to go back to the idea of immigration, is that as much as it tells the story of Italian immigrants in New York, it also touches on an aspect of immigration that I feel is really very rarely talked about, which is returnees. A number of people who arrived in the United States through Ellis Island actually went back because they didn't work out. And you never hear those stories. And yeah. What's great about this one is we get to get a glimpse of, like, some, you know, Michael returning to Italy. So we get to get a glimpse of Italy too. And with the complications of family there as well.
Yeah, and it's the confrontation of that legacy, right? Like, you know, Michael has to go back, and it's the complication of the legacy of leaving You know, his father Vito has adopted the name of the town, and we learn in part two. Obviously, I generally just think of part one and two as the same movie at this point. Like they're just so like everything. But you know that at Ellis Island, he was forced to take that name because the names got changed all the time in that process. So he's going back to this homeland. You know, but he's still tied to the States and like the family there, and the recourse of his actions. You know, they had to go to the mattresses, they had to go to war, like it's this bloodshed, you know, and it's all to this point, like building up to this point of, you know, like you're saying, in terms of the returnees, it's like what exists between you now? Like what chasm now exists? Like what does it mean to try to repatriate and to try to reconnect? And yeah. You know, he marries, right? Like he marries in this town, right? Like he's building a new life, but everything also is catching up with him.
Yeah. And remember that when he arrives, his Italian is extremely poor, and he requires a translator when he courts that beautiful young girl. I love the scene where they're together and then the camera pans and you see that they're being followed by half the village. And that reminded me of how it was. I mean, in Morocco, that's how it was. Like you're not actually going on a date. Like your little sister, or your little brother, or your cousin, you're never actually physically alone. So I love that. And I love that, you know, that he has these language problems and that he has trouble, you know, fitting in and courting and doing all of that. And of course it all gets lost. And one of the beautiful things about this movie too, and I can't remember if the scene is in part one or part two, but at one point, this might be in part one where this is what I was going to say. In part one, he's sitting and he's narrating the wedding, right? Kind of in this kind of. But then I think it's in part two where he's sitting at the table and the character played by Michael Caine gets up. They're all getting up. And then he says he's the last one at the table, and it's a flashback scene, and he's wearing and this is at the point in the movie, but like at this point, Michael has become fully, you know, he's a killer.
He's a Don. Yeah.
So he starts out as the outsider. He joins the family, but even within the family, he becomes the outsider. They blame him for the decisions that he makes. His sister is angry at him. Everybody's angry at him, and he's never really like, even though he takes charge of the family, in a sense, he continues to be the black sheep. Like he's still kind of the outsider. This is something that always gets me about this movie.
Ah, that little farce you played with my sister. You think that could fool the Corleone?
Mike, I'm innocent. I swear to kids. Please, Mike, don't do this to me. Please.
Don't be afraid, Carlo. Come on, you think I make my sister a widow? I'm godfather to your son, Carlo. No, Carlo, you're out of the family business. That's your punishment. You're finished.
Yeah, it's so funny. I've never really thought of it that way. And I've always, you know, you always want to associate with Michael because he's like the most put together, right? Like that's, you know, like, no, I'm definitely a Michael. I'm not a Fredo.
Right? Nobody wants to be a Fredo.
But I think that that's really where my connection with Michael comes in the way that you beautifully put that, is that there's always, like, for me, there's always this sense of like an outsiderness within my family, within like, you know, the professional realm. Like, there's always this sense that I'm slightly off from everyone else, you know? And like for Michael, it's working, you know, in some ways, right? Like, he's very successful as the Don, right? Like, he definitely can wear that cloak, and he, like, you can see it in the shift of his body language and his speaking patterns, right? Like from when he's outside the family to when he takes on the responsibilities of the Don. But his decision making always upsets someone, right? Like, he's always having some business trouble. He's always having some family trouble because he is, it's like, it's the feeling of like, I'm just not being understood here. And then I'm just like, I'm just not being understood.
Mobster, and I'm not being understood. Yeah. It's interesting too about Fredo, because this is obviously a movie about, you know, extremely violent mobsters, criminals. I mean, they're murderers, they're, you know, they do all kinds of things. But the true villain in the movie is, you know, Fredo, and Fredo's great crime is that he betrays the family, right? Mm-hmm. There's a scene where Michael tells him, Fredo, don't ever take side with someone other than the family again. Mm-hmm. So in the universe of the movie, the greatest sin you can commit is not to kill, maim, steal, mm-hmm. do any of that. The greatest crime you can ever commit is to betray your family. Which I think is such an interesting position from a moral point of view. I just find that really interesting. I really do. It's something that I think about a lot. It's something that all of us can relate to, right? Yeah. Is that the worst thing I've done in my life? But at least I've been on the side of my family.
But it comes back to what we were discussing before, in that, like, when the family becomes everything, and it's not, it's about your family against the world, against these great institutions, these powerful institutions, like, and that you've created a world in which you all protect one another and you prosper together, to betray that, to take sides against the family, is to side with something that, like, you have no control over, to say, like, you're relinquishing that, as if to say that, like, your family has not done everything that they've done for you, that they don't provide everything that they provided for you, that all of the labor, all of the murdering, all of that went into sustaining that life is for naught. Like, you're going to just take sides with someone else against everything that I've done for you to try to protect you here. Like, I can sense that as, like, that would be a huge betrayal.
And then, of course, it's also a movie that, like, comments on, you know, the effects of immigration on multiple generations. So mm-hmm. the fact that the Godfather's generation, the original Marlon Brando's character, mm-hmm. the Godfather, there's certain cultural differences between him and his American born children. Mm-hmm. He feels that they're different, and it takes them a while to be trained. And then just the different, the fact that some of them, for example, are not, don't have documents. At the beginning of the first movie, right after The Undertaker, somebody comes in and asks for help with immigration papers. Mm-hmm. And Godfather says, we will get the Jew congressman to do this. Remember that line?
Yes, yes.
It can't be traced to them. And so there's all kinds of things like that about immigration that I think there's these, you know, slight commentary. And then, of course, in the second movie, when we see Marlon Brando's character, origin story, we see that he came as an unaccompanied minor. But mm-hmm. before that. Yeah. So it's like all of these, like, family dynamics and just, like, in general dynamics within a neighborhood that are completely determined by, like, immigration status and the story of
he's in the that scene, you know, he can't refuse the favor on the day of his daughter's wedding, right? And the baker comes in, and he's like, my daughter, she's in love with this boy that works for me, Enzo. And, you know, he's not, and it's like, it's so interesting. And, you know, obviously, you know, in our current political climate, a sort of discussion around immigration and the keeping people out and all of this stuff. And it's like, there's an understanding that, like, again, I can't go through the proper channels to get this done, to protect this boy that, like, I want him to stay here, be a part of my business, be a part of my family, and that there's only these other means, right? And it's the question to say, like, why is that so difficult? Why is it so difficult for this, like, and we're not even talking about, like, people who would be characters that, like, you know, the right wing in this country likes to characterize it, like, as caricature immigrants as, is like villains and criminals and all this stuff. We're just talking about a boy who's working in a bakery, right? Like, who's in love with a girl, and there's no path for him. And if there's no path for him, there's no path for anyone.
Yeah, yeah.
I hope you don't mind the way I keep going over this Bassini business.
No, not at all.
It's an old habit. I spend my life trying not to be careless. Women and children can be careless, but not men.
Yeah, it's a beautiful movie. I never get tired of seeing it.
I never do. I truly don't. And I think about it a lot because I've thought about this recently for a number of different reasons, but like I think of it as being perfect. And like when I say that, I don't mean that it's literally perfect in that I love the scene, but I still don't understand how the horse head actually got in the bed. like there are little things that like just maybe they just like needed to. And have you been watching the Offer, the this little series that they have of the making of?
I tried very valiantly. I saw that they were making a mini series about this. Mm-hmm. And for the 50th anniversary, the picture being released. And my husband used to work, he's an engineer, but he used to work for Paramount Pictures. So we used to constantly, you know, sometimes we pick him up from work, I would have to go on the lot and see that. And so when, what's his name? Bob Evans came out with his autobiography, The Kids in the Picture, I read that and he talks about like making The Godfather. So when I found out that they were doing this miniseries, I'm like, let's see what they, and it is so bad. It's so bad. Did you watch it?
Yeah, I mean it's bad. Yes, it's bad.
I thought it was. I mean, I'm like they're sort of, you know, stereotypical viewer, right? Like you're a fan of the movie, familiar with the names.
Yeah,
you know, familiar with everything that's going on. And I unfortunately didn't think that it did. It just, I don't know.
It doesn't do it justice at all. It's just, it's very like, it's a made for TV movie and just in the era of streaming where it's just like, you have a bunch of people doing these imitations of these things. It's like sort of fan service where they drop in a line or a reference here and there. And it's just so sensationalized with all of the like real life mobsters and stuff like, and it's just like it's too much, it's too chaotic. I only bring it up to say that, like, you know, you're sort of watching that unfold in the way that they made it. And like, maybe there are things that they just had to rush through, they couldn't afford, that like the tension between art and commerce were just coming to a head. And there's like little things about the film that are maybe a little off sometimes. Yeah. But when I say that it's a perfect movie, I think that like the commentary, like the things that it gets us to think about, the way that it is like commenting on the American dream, on power, on capital, on immigration, on family, and all of these things, and telling a truly compelling story while doing all of that. Like, how does it get better? Right? Like,
I love it. And that's one of the reasons I love it. And I think that it's because it sort of has like the, sort of the candy wrapping, right? The part that's the candy is like the mystery and like who's, you know, how do you catch this guy? And, you know, all that, the sort of action. But then the stuff that's inside that's really interesting is all these themes that you mentioned. So it has, the movie does this perfect combination, like you said, of art and commerce, like really perfectly married. And the one thing I did like about that miniseries, The Offer, is that the parts where they show Francis Ford Coppola working with Mario Puzo on this, I thought that was really interesting to see see how they came up with some of the scenes, and then some of the sacrifices just choices that they were forced to make. Like, for example, there's a scene where, you know, just to not offend whichever, you know, gangster, they agreed to not have the word mafia in the movie. The producer thinks it's going to be a big ask, but it turns out to be an easy, it's like, okay, done, let's move on. So those parts I liked. And honestly, watching it, it's a wonder that the movie ever got made, just because of that stood in the way. And then not wanting to cast, what's his name, Al Pacino, who of course is just incredible in this movie. Incredible.
His role.
Every everybody in it is so good. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like every single actor in it is good. And just, I mean, I'm sure the credit has to go to the director for getting these wonderful performances out of them. Yeah. So just from, you know, visually, it's so beautiful. And then, of course, the acting is perfect. The story is great. So many iconic lines.
Yeah. And I this sort of inevitability is thinking about it in the context of like other gangster films, right? And, you know, I saw The Godfather. I was probably like 18 or something the first time that I watched The Godfather, and have just been watching it at least twice a year ever since, right? But I saw Goodfellas a little later, and like, because I was like, oh, I do like these gangster movies. There's something that draws me to them. But I think also that The Godfather, because of its complexity, was something that was like, well, maybe there's more here to sort of explore these kinds of things. So I saw Goodfellas later, and I didn't like Goodfellas the first time that I watched it. It took me a while to appreciate it. And I think there was, upon learning this, I think it's clarified what my sort of initial reactions were. It's like neither Mario Puzo or Francis Ford Coppola like actually knew any mobsters or like consulted with any mobs. Like they really weren't telling that story, right? Like they weren't looking for realism there. Francis Ford Coppola was looking at like King Lear, right? Like he's thinking of this in very like epic terms and like, you know, in the history of film and stuff. Like he's like trying to be Orson Welles more than he's trying to capture the reality of the mafia way Scorsese was doing. And it's like, that's a particular story and it's interesting on its own. But like, I think I was drawn more to the storytelling aspects of that, like, and the grounding in the family and all of those various themes that The Godfather offers, as opposed to like getting the real deal of what mob life is. Like, I'm just not that curious about it.
That's so interesting that in fact, like trying to make something socially realist ends up hampering the bigger picture here, right? Mm-hmm. Like so and of course, you know, in The Offer they talk about how much there was fear among Italian Americans. Of course, you said that the movie came out in 1972, so this is a long time ago, and people had very different attitudes back then, and so they were nervous about being further ostracized. And of course the movie was, I think it really, I mean, you can't watch it and not fall in love with Italian Americans, because it's such a, again, the focus being on family, not on realism, not on whether this is exactly how mobsters react or this is exactly how they they go back murdering or whatever it is they do, but just by talking about them as human beings, basically instead of saying these are monsters, saying these monsters are human beings. And by doing that, then all of us can actually sympathize with them. So.
Yeah, exactly. Layla, what's one lasting image that sticks with you from The Godfather?
The Godfather. That's a good question. I knew you were going to ask me that. Did I even write it down? Of course not. That would be too organized. There's so many. I mean, I don't even know. But the one that, because we just rewatched it maybe a month ago. And so when I got your email, I was like, oh, well, it has to be the problem. And the one scene we kept talking about, and this must be in the first movie, the character of James Caan, the middle brother. Mm-hmm. Name escapes me just now, but there is a scene where he, you know, he's a hothead and he has opinions about what his father should do, and they're making some kind of a deal, and he, you know, yells at the other guy, and the Godfather Marlon Brando, when the guy leaves, he goes, never let them know what you think.
yeah never let anyone outside the family know what you're thinking.
And I was like, you know what? That is very sage advice. Very sage advice. You can apply it to many different things, but that's the scene that I've been thinking about on this last rewatch. But yeah, honestly, there's so many in the movie. And you know, the opening, I always talk about that when I talk about
Yeah. I don't normally do this, but because it is my favorite, I'm taking the liberty to also say which one is my, like,
yes, and please, I would love to know.
It's like, they, you know, Vito's been shot. We've been at the hospital. Michael's been punched in the face by the police officer. And then they're back home. And, you know, Tom Hagen is just telling Sonny, like, it's not personal. It's business. You're reacting from, like, all of this. And then they like have their little discussion. And then we pan over and there's Michael just sitting, face swollen from the break.
Yes, the meeting, yes.
And then we're just like slowly coming into him as he just details this plan of how he's going to kill Sollozzo and McCluskey. And it's just, it's beautifully done, but it's also just that moment of shifting, right? Like, the power of the room has been sucked out, like, and it's just like, just completely transferring to Michael. He is coming into his own. He understands his role. He knows who he has to be now. Like, he's already declared to his father, I'm with you. And it's just like, it, I can't escape the power of it, right? Like, it's just so, and there's so much resonant in there to just be like, look, I am the youngest brother, but I'm the wisest, and I know. And then there's so much just wrapped up in that about just like we were discussing, of like this being the person that was supposed to be the fulfillment of the dream, but he's like sucked into the family business that is full of just violence and antisocial behaviors all around. And it's just like, it gets me every single time.
Yeah. And it marks the beginning of his transformation into the,
yeah.
His eyes, Al Pacino's eyes in that scene are so magnetic and so, like, he communicates so much throughout the movie just through a look.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting, you know, the younger brother, obviously he's neither as he's not a hothead like Sonny.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not as ambitious as Fredo. He just was content to be on the sidelines. And then, of course, when the moment comes to act, he's the one who's willing to.
Yeah.
So, ooh.
Layla, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to Open Form, a podcast from Lit Hub Radio, produced by Eliza Smith and Justin Alvarez, and hosted by me, Michael Denzel Smith. Feel free to like, comment, and subscribe to Open Form wherever you get your podcasts, and or sign up for the Lit Hub newsletter to stay up to date on our latest episodes. If you're enjoying what you hear, share Open Form with a friend or on social media. Next week, Bueller, Bueller, Bueller.